And it's just about 6 o'clock. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next, Wart Local News.
Well, I'm that hoochie-coochie man.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Tuesday, March 18th. I'm your host, Christian Knutson.
And I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. In tonight's news, a new study examines how often homicide is a cause of death for Indigenous women and girls.
A self-described policy wonk runs for a West Side seat on Madison City Council.
And in the second half, the Milkweed examines an economic pain looming for the dairy industry. WORT checks in with a local farm-to-school program, and Wildlife Weekly outlines the challenges of treating animals that are bonded for life.
All these stories and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for reports from around the world.
Hello, this is the BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukrainian infrastructure has been hit in a large-scale Russian drone attack, hours after Vladimir Putin told Donald Trump that Moscow would halt attacks against Ukrainian energy targets. Earlier, in a telephone call with Mr. Trump, the Russian president said a full ceasefire would only work if Ukraine's allies stopped giving Kyiv military assistance. From Kyiv, James Landill reports.
Donald Trump wants an unconditional, immediate ceasefire across Ukraine. But after his telephone call with Vladimir Putin, the US president was offered merely a partial ceasefire with conditions attached. The Kremlin said Russia's president would also begin talks about a broader ceasefire if it eliminated the root causes of the war. In response, President Zelensky said he would support any end to Russian attacks on his country's infrastructure, but he noted the irony that the promise was made as air raid sirens rang out across Ukraine.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that renewed airstrikes on Gaza are just the beginning. He accused Hamas of rejecting the proposals Israel had brought to ceasefire talks. More than 400 people are reported to have been killed since the strikes began on Monday night. Mike Thompson reports.
Despite widespread international criticism, Israel's prime minister was making no apologies for resuming military action against Hamas. Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to use full force in the battle to defeat the group and ensure the release of hostages. Past hostage releases, he said, prove that military pressure brings results. Families of some of the hostages argue that such a policy means sacrificing the lives of their loved ones. But an undeterred Mr. Netanyahu insisted that from now on, negotiations with Hamas will only be done under fire.
Two NASA astronauts have just returned to Earth, ending a nine-month stay in space, which was originally supposed to last just 8 days. The SpaceX capsule carrying Butch Wilmore, Sonny Williams and two other astronauts splashed down off the coast of Florida. This is how it sounded in Mission Control.
And splashdown. Crew 9, back on Earth.
And SpaceX Freedom, splashdown. Good main release.
Copy, splashdown. We see main chutes cut. Nick, Alex, Butch, Sonny, on behalf of SpaceX, welcome home.
A federal judge has ordered an immediate stop to the shutdown of the main U.S. aid agency by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. The judge said it was likely that the attempt to close USAID violated the U.S. Constitution. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The Chief Justice of the United States has issued a rare public rebuke after Donald Trump called for the impeachment of a federal judge. James Boasberg ordered the suspension of several deportation flights. From Washington, here's Gary O'Donoghue.
In a social media post, Donald Trump called Judge Boasberg a radical left lunatic, a troublemaker and an agitator, adding that he should be impeached, in other words, removed from office. While not addressing the president directly, the statement from the Chief Justice, John Roberts, represents an unequivocal admonishment of the president's words. America's political system is based on three branches of government: the executive, Congress and the judiciary, and this separation of powers is designed to create a system of checks and balances so that no one branch can dominate the others.
The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, and his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, have called for a ceasefire in eastern Congo after having direct talks in Qatar. A joint statement said it should be immediate and unconditional. It's unclear whether that would stop the M23, which now controls more territory in DRC than ever. Hungary's parliament has voted to ban annual pride celebrations across the country in the latest clampdown on LGBT rights by Viktor Orban's far-right government. The legislation approves the use of facial recognition technology to identify and fine anyone attending such events. The US government has said there's no evidence Britain's Prince Harry received special treatment when he applied for an American visa in 2020. Immigration officials produced documents related to his application, but they heavily redacted large portions, saying they had a duty to protect his privacy. A conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, had argued that the public had a right to know if the British royal had disclosed a history of drug use. BBC News.
This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in Spring Lake, downtown Madison.
In-person early voting began today as we are officially 2 weeks before the spring election. The April 1st election will see a variety of nonpartisan candidates running for local and state offices. Perhaps the biggest is the battle for ideological control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Spending in the race between Liberal candidate Susan Crawford and Conservative candidate Brand Schibel is in the tens of millions of dollars, reports the Associated Press. That spending breaks the 2023 record as the most expensive court election in U.S. history. Much of those campaign funds comes from out-of-state mega donors like centibillionaire oligarch Elon Musk, who has provided more than $11 million in support of Schimmel. Schimmel's national backing extends beyond cash. Donald Trump Jr. came to Wisconsin yesterday to rally in support of the conservative candidate in the race. Trump Jr. joined conservative media figure Charlie Kirk in Oconomowoc for an event with Turning Point USA, a right-wing group that targets young voters. Speaking to the crowd, Trump Jr. stressed that Schimmel's win next month is crucial in advancing the Trump administration's agenda.
In other election news, some Wisconsin voters received handwritten postcards last week with inaccurate voting information, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The postcards list an incorrect election date of April 11th, 10 days after the actual election date of April 1st. The postcards, which backed Liberal candidate Susan Crawford, likely stem from a Liberal group that organizes handwritten postcard campaigns nationally. There is one place you can go for accurate voting information. That's the statewide website run by the Wisconsin Elections Commission at myvote.wi.gov. There you can see where to vote and what will be on your ballot, or track the status of your absentee ballot. And you'll also see the correct election date, which is April 1st.
Tourism spending in Milwaukee experienced a steep decline last July, the same month the city hosted the Republican National Convention. That's according to sales data from the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Though RNC organizers and city business folks promised that hosting the convention would create an economic boom of $200 million for the area, spending on tourism-related industries actually went down in the month of July. Restaurants, bars, performing arts, sports, museums, and casinos experienced a decline in revenue. One industry did see a boom. The hospitality industry saw an astronomical increase of nearly $18 million. According to Victor Matheson, a Massachusetts-based economics professor who studies the economic impact of political conventions, events of this size, quote, crowd out other sort of economic activity that would normally be happening in the area, unquote.
Thomas Fowler, chairman of the St. Croix Chippewa Indians of Wisconsin, delivered the State of the Tribes address today at the Wisconsin State Capitol. He touched on issues from Indian boarding schools to legalizing medical marijuana. Fowler began by thanking Native American military veterans and shared that his tribal government recently began determining membership by lineal descent rather than blood quantum, which describes the percentage of indigenous DNA a person has. The reasoning for this, Fowler said, is to ensure, quote, our sovereignty continues on forever, unquote. Fowler also shared the lingering memory of Indian boarding schools, which separated Native children from their families, assimilating them into American culture. He implored lawmakers to help propel a pending federal bill titled the Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies. This bill would investigate the impacts and ongoing effects of Indian boarding schools, protect unmarked graves, support repatriation of human remains, identify the tribal nations the children were removed from, and ultimately discontinue the removal of Native children from their families and tribal communities. This practice still takes place today under social service departments, foster care, and adoption agencies. Fowler also highlighted substance abuse and drug overdoses, pointing to medical marijuana as a potential solution that could help reduce the use of highly addictive drugs. Meanwhile, Fowler commended Wisconsin's collaborative relationship with tribal nations in facilitating language immersion. He said indigenous languages are heading, quote, in the right direction to find ways to build our vocabulary back, unquote.
The Wisconsin Senate is advancing a bill that would undo changes the State Department of Public Instruction enacted last year, policies that altered cutoff scores and achievement-level terminology within state testing standards. If the bill becomes law, the state's testing standards would revert back to what they were in 2019, requiring adherence to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Republican legislators claim that the agency's changes lowered the state's academic standards, and they claim the bill will help to raise academic standards in the state. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction said these changes did not lower standards and say that the national report card is not very helpful for understanding whether students have met the state's academic standards. Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who has been critical of the testing standard changes, told Wisconsin Examiner he will likely veto the bill, believing that the state's Department of Public Instruction should be calling the shots about state testing. The National Assessment of Educational Progress is housed within the U.S. Department of Education, which the Trump administration has targeted with widespread layoffs and program cancellations.
A state bill requiring county sheriffs to cooperate with ICE took another step forward today. Assembly Bill 24 would require sheriffs to comply with detainers and administrative warrants issued by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. It would also require that sheriffs request citizenship documentation from inmates being held in jails on a felony charge. The bill is expressly targeted at the sheriffs of Dane and Milwaukee counties, both of which are characterized by ICE as non-cooperative institutions. If sheriffs don't comply, the bill proposes a steep financial penalty, a 15% reduction in state funding. The bill passed the Assembly by a party-line vote. Its companion bill in the state Senate has yet to be heard.
After 2 years of breaking records for low ice, coverage on the Great Lakes this past winter was back to relatively normal, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ice coverage on the Great Lakes peaked in February, reaching up to 52% ice coverage on average, and has been receding since February's cold snap. That's according to data from the U.S. National Ice Center. That's good news this year for fish and other life in the Great Lakes. Ice helps protect the lake ecosystem, sheltering fish eggs from wind and waves, limiting phytoplankton and algae blooms, and reducing flooding and erosion on the lakeshore. Overall, though, ice coverage is on a gradual decline, fueled by climate change. Those were tonight's headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Homicide is one of the leading causes of death for Indigenous women and girls. They account for less than 1% of the U.S. population, yet are more than three times more likely to be murdered than white women. Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection has the details on a new study that's raising alarms.
Indigenous people have made great contributions to the state of Wisconsin, yet the alarming rates of violence against them remains a public health crisis. A new study shows that intimate partner violence disproportionately impacts Indigenous women more than any other ethnic or racial group in the U.S. The murder rate for Native American women and girls is up to 10 times higher than the national average, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, yet they account for less than 1% of the population. Desiree Toady Kirby with the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse is a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin. She says violence against Native women is underreported and unaddressed.
There's jurisdictional issues that come into play as to how things are investigated, how things are tried, and there's always racism. There's less attention paid to the individuals that some of these things happen to.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice created a task force to combat violence against Native women across the state after legislation that would have addressed these issues failed to pass. There are currently no upcoming task force meetings listed on the newly updated DOJ website. Poor tracking and data collection are just some of the many issues that contribute to the epidemic amongst Indigenous women. During a multi-state march last month, Toti read a list of names of Indigenous people from Minnesota who had died from domestic violence. No such list currently exists for Wisconsin, and Toti says she's working on changing that. She emphasizes the great need to address the systems in place that continue to fail Native people.
I have three daughters that I want them to grow up as strong Native women, and I want them to grow up safely as strong Native women. I mean, this is their futures on the line. This is their ability to walk down a street safely.
Research shows Indigenous women also face significant barriers when seeking help after experiencing domestic violence. A survivor herself, Toti works with CASDA to provide resources for those affected in Bayfield and Ashland counties. Governor Evers has proposed a $20 million funding increase for domestic abuse services in his current executive budget. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust syndicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It's now 6:17 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Anthony Nino Amato has decades of experience in state and city government. After a term on the Madison City Council and an unsuccessful run for mayor in the 1970s, Amato served under two Wisconsin governors and five Madison mayors. Amato ran for city council again in 2023, but lost to the current District 9 alder, Nikki Conklin. Living in a different district this spring, Amato is challenging incumbent District 19, Alder John Uger. While Amato is on the ballot, his ability to take the seat if elected is up in the air. Amato blames bad advice from the city clerk's office in interpreting a state statute that requires local alder candidates live in the district they're running for 28 days ahead of the election. Amato sat down with WRT News producer Faye Parks to reintroduce himself ahead of Election Day.
Hi, I'm Nino Amato. I'm actually a Madisonian. There are a few of us still in Madison. My grandparents immigrated from Italy at the turn of the century when they saw the rising fascism. So there was an already established immigration community called the Greenbush. And so that's where my two grandfathers and one grandmother brought us up. Education was big, so I did my undergraduate at UW-Madison teacher certification in political science at Deach High School. And I also did my master's at the LaFollette Institute of Public Policy. And I've had the pleasure to serve on the UW Board of Regents and on the UW Hospital Authority Board and under two different governors. And then I've served on numerous committee boards and commissions. I have served under Mayor Skornica, Mayor Sensenbrenner, Dave Cheslevich, Paul Soglin, Sue Bauman, and Paul Soglin again. And I helped elect current mayor back in 2019. So I've been very much involved, and now I'm running for city council.
You've described your experience as a leader and in politics in the past. Can you sort of walk us through more what your approach is to communications, a really important part of being an alder?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, constituent relations is number one. And what is a really driving issue throughout, not just the 19th District, but throughout the city, is that for so long, Madison's history has been a city where residents and neighborhood groups could be heard and government would listen to you. Unfortunately, in the last 4 years, the reverse has happened. So when it comes to constituent relations, people want to reverse the current top-down autocratic trend in City Hall and have city officials and our elected officials start listening to us. I think that's a major, major issue. To me, leadership is not a popularity contest. Leadership is knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know. And good leaders will take what they don't know and hire the very best people to surround themselves with and to be contentious if necessary so you don't get trapped in this yes, yes, whatever you say, boss type of mentality.
Now, you previously ran for Common Council District 9 in 2023. What inspired you to run again this year, this time in District 19?
Well, actually, I ran for the city council in District 20 when I was a graduate student in 1975. And I was elected on Madison's West Side. And then I was encouraged to run here in the 9th District, which I did. I had supported Nikki Conklin in her first term go around. But like everybody at my stage in life, I downsided. I got a full price offer on my condo here at Tamarack. And then I made an offer, and that was accepted, on a smaller home in Wexford, where I used to live. In fact, I've lived on the West Side for over 47 years. And when my friends found out that I moved back in my own neighborhood, I was approached by a number of neighborhood leaders, including Christine Slack, who is the former alder of the 19th District and was encouraged to run. And when I saw the groundswell of support, and since we didn't have anyone else to run and John was going to be unopposed, I decided to throw my hat in the ring.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Now, you've been an outspoken critic of Mayor Rhodes Conway and the council's choice to raise property taxes to address the budget deficit. Can you describe in more detail what direction you would like to see the city government go in the next few years?
Instead of working together and creating a task force of both public and private sector people, figure out how we can really address the structural deficit. The mayor came up with a fear-based budget. And if you weren't a policy wonk, you would have went ahead and voted yes. So people did, not by a big margin, about 53%. But here's the slap in the face. 2 weeks after it passed, the mayor and the council bragged that they had a $20 million surplus. And I've had over two dozen meets and greets, and people are angry where they have said they lied to us. They scared us in voting yes. And if we get new council members on, I know Sadia enough that she's pragmatic. We can all work together and turn this around. So to me, the best achievement right now is to have not a five-year plan. Nobody can project out 5 years. We need a plan looking 1 and 2 years down the road. Prioritize what essential services people need, probably turn around and develop a better accounting system that is more transparent, and then collaboratively work together through an iterative process. And when I say work together, I like the Zoom meetings. I think it's good for the public, but I think council members need to be in the room interacting with each other, which really adds value in building relationships. And secondly, when I was on the council all the way through Dave Cheslevich years, we met once a week, not twice a month. You cannot manage a $625 million budget meeting only twice a month. So I would encourage, from a standpoint of achievement, that we collaborate. We're all in the same room. We let the public attend in person or be on Zoom. And we look at ways where we can work together and be transparent and probably pause, is the word I'd use, pause any new major construction jobs, because what's driving the budgets is in 2024, I believe, we had a $63 million interest payment for all the borrowing we took. So we've got to whittle that down. So to me, we need to button down the hatches. We need to work together to weather the storm and hope that 2 years from now, the House and the Senate changes, and that by that time we'll be ready to move forward in a more productive, collaborative way.
Housing is perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job paying about $28 per hour or $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
I think what we have to do is step back. The city owns a tremendous amount of real estate. And when you have opportunities of the properties we own to build multifamily rental housing at a discount or small studios and one bedrooms that accommodate the new young professionals or condominiums, what you don't do is take the Hartmeyer Ice Arena and the Westside Ice Arena and forgive their debt, and then you don't sell the value of those two properties for $1. $1. And the mayor sponsored the legislation, and so did John Huguere. That was a horrendous giveaway, and people are angry about it. That property should come back to us because we did an assessed value on the two parcels of land, which equals about 11 acres in total. Market value of that property is anywhere from $5 to $7 million. Now, if we hung on to that, and if I get elected, I'm going to look into it to see whether or not we can renegotiate that contract. The next step is we have to close the economic racial disparities between the underserved and those who are doing exceptionally well. You are not going to close the economic divide by building more apartments. You need people to build wealth. You do it with affordable condominiums, and you make incentives for the developers to basically do it. We need to build economic wealth for those who right now are trying to get in the housing market. So, you know, we can't keep trying to solve the problems the same way we got into them. We've got to bring things from a different perspective. And I think I bring that perspective, what I consider rigorous due diligence that's needed to look at every angle, listen to people, and then if we work together, we can make it happen.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents in their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
You ask, how do you balance that? You balance with a referendum. And where the mayor is the first mayor in the history of Madison that took the largest pot of money from the federal government, which is the BRT, which I support, a bus rapid transit system, but more regional, Dane County based, and didn't put that up for referendum. Why? Because I don't think she could have sold it. You go to referendum if you can't solve it with enough people. And I believe direct democracy is important. And I also believe that too many council members have forgotten that they're representative of their districts. So you need to educate them on broader issues and hopefully bring them along, but you also represent their votes on environmental concerns.
Anthony Nino Amato is running for Common Council this spring. He's challenging current Westside Alder John Huguere. You can learn more about Amato's campaign on his website, AmatoForMadison.com. That's A-M-A-T-O for F-O-R Madison.com.
You're listening to Local News by Local People here on WORT.
Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. The Milkweed looks at the relationship between tariffs and dairy prices.
WORT gets an update from a Madison-based farm-to-school program.
And Wildlife Weekly describes the difficulties of providing medical care to animals with lifelong mates.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
Care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers. BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukrainian infrastructure has been hit in a large-scale Russian drone attack, hours after Vladimir Putin told Donald Trump that Moscow would stop targeting Ukrainian energy sites. In his telephone call with the American leader, President Putin said a full ceasefire would only work if Ukraine's allies stopped giving Kyiv military assistance. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the fight against Hamas with growing intensity. He was speaking after Israeli airstrikes on Gaza reportedly killed more than 400 people. The Chief Justice of the United States has issued a rare public rebuke after Donald Trump called for the impeachment of a federal judge. The president accused James Boasberg of being a radical left lunatic after he ordered the suspension of several deportation flights. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, and his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, have called for a truce in eastern Congo after having direct talks in Qatar. It's unclear whether the ceasefire call will stop the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. Hungary's parliament has voted to ban annual pride celebrations. The legislation approves the use of facial recognition technology to identify and fine anyone attending such events. Two American astronauts have returned to Earth, ending a nine-month stay that was supposed to last just 8 days. Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams arrived at the International Space Station last June, but their spacecraft suffered a technical fault. A federal judge has ordered an immediate stop to the shutdown of the main US aid agency by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. The district court judge said it was likely that the attempt to close USAID violated the US Constitution. And that's the latest BBC News.
The time is now 6:33 and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us.
There's a painful economic reality looming for Wisconsin's dairy industry. That's according to Pete Harden, who tells host Bert Zipperer that Trump's tariffs chaos is bringing down dairy commodity prices. Feature producer Christine Vertico brings us this edition of The Milkweed.
Welcome to The Milkweed on WORT. I'm Bert Zipperer, and today we're talking with Pete Harden, who for 46 years has been the publisher and editor of the monthly newspaper The Milkweed, dairy farming's best information and insights, with their motto, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Pete, today's topic is the collapse of dairy commodity prices. So talk about commodities, would you?
There's a painful economic ouch coming across Wisconsin's dairy industry. It's here now, and it's probably going to get worse. Bert, dairy commodities, which is a term we should clearly define, mm-hmm. we're referring to bulk quantities of cheddar cheese, bulk butter, bulk non-fat dry milk, fat-free powdered milk, and then dry whey, all of which are major items produced in Wisconsin, but primarily cheddar cheese. The dairy industry concluded 24 as one of the greatest years ever in terms of accelerated consumer demand across the board. Cottage cheese, yogurt, ice cream, even fluid milk sales were up. And then heading into 25, all of a sudden, the dark clouds, starting with the campaign rhetoric about tariffs against our neighbors to the north and the south, have driven down the dairy commodity prices in 2025. It's been particularly accelerated since Mr. Trump took office.
So it's been only 6 to 8 weeks. What's going on?
Mexico and Canada are the United States' two biggest export destinations for dairy products. Mm-hmm. The threats of trade wars against these two nations have caused dairy marketers to back off their willingness to put away inventories. They're not willing to pay the previous higher prices simply because they do not know what the demand prospects are going to be for exporting cheddar, butter, milk mm-hmm. powder, whey. Mexico bought 38% of all our cheese exports last year, 10% of our butter, 50% of our non-fat dry milk. Canada bought 61% of our combined butter and cream exports. So these are huge buyers, close by, friendly, you know, minimum transportation distances. And now we're seeing across the board, again, the dairy commodities we referred to, their prices have dropped since sometime in January, roughly 20 to 28 cents per pound, just down, 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 down.
That's huge.
It's going to have a negative impact on Wisconsin's dairy industry from farm to the inventory warehouse.
What about the effect on farmers here in Wisconsin?
Dramatic. I estimate that we're having this interview on, March 13. I estimate if the current dairy commodity levels hold, particularly for cheese and whey, that by April, Wisconsin dairy farmers will see at least a $4 per hundredweight loss in their milk income compared to January of 2025.
Wow.
That's about a 20% drop in milk prices coming at the same time that spring planting expenses are being incurred, and that the spring planting expenses are a big seasonal bump in dairy farmers' annual expenses incurred.
And it's always been true that the farmers are stuck between two entities. They don't control the prices that they get for their products, and they don't control the costs that they have to pay for the inputs.
Correct. And I estimate this is at $4 a hundredweight decline in milk income to Wisconsin farmers. I estimate by April they will see $100 million per month less milk income than they saw in January. And that's a big drop.
And this is from going to war, economic war, against our neighbors,
yes.
our friends.
No less, say, an expert than Warren Buffett, the great socialist, said these trade wars are, in fact, economic warfare. And it's economic warfare against our two closest neighbors and our two biggest trading partners, and essentially for no good reason. Take Canada, for example. Canada's economy is highly dependent upon trade with the United States, like particularly autos, automobile parts, lumber, steel. Those are among the big ones for Canada. Canada, again, I mentioned they bought 61% of all our butter and cream exports last year. But in terms of the issues such as that have been raised challenging Canada's way of doing things, there are virtually no fentanyl imports entering the U.S. from Canada. I think in a recent year, the most recent year for which the data is available, we managed to find 43 pounds of fentanyl trying to cross the Canadian border. And the number of illegal immigrants crossing the border is very, very small compared to our southern border.
You were talking earlier before we went on the air about how bogus this drug charge is. It's similar to the Iraqi war.
Absolutely. As listeners may recall, the reasons for us going to war against Saddam Hussein early in the Bush 2 administration was the allegations that he had weapons of mass destruction, including I guess, atomic weapons. Totally bogus reason for us going to war. And you look at the chaos and the sadness that has followed since that bogus war. Well, this trade war with Canada and Mexico is just about as bogus as the Iraqi war against Saddam Hussein.
I think it's a really important analogy. So what do we have to keep in mind as we head into 2025 with all the economic chaos going on at the federal level?
That's a hard question to answer, Bert, because that chaos keeps unraveling. Good question. I think what we're seeing is that, let's put it this way, the dairy industry is heavily Republican in its politics, and that's their perfect right. However, I think as the economic losses to the farmers pile up and the economic losses to the inventory holders, such as cheese plants and cheese marketing firms, as these losses pile up, the cheering in rural America for the Trump policies is going to come to an abrupt slowdown when they see the economic results. And it's kind of sad that our dairy industry failed to realize the dangers of the rhetoric during the presidential campaign and now is about to pay a price, in my opinion.
Exactly. Well, that's it for this week with the Milkweed. We'll be back next week with Pete Hardin here on WORT. Thanks for listening.
It's now 6:41 p.m. and you're bathing in the live local news on WORT. With USDA farm-to-school grants currently on hold, schools now face an increased financial burden and many garden programs are at risk. Erica Krug is the farm-to-school director at Rooted, an educational and food program that operates three locations around Madison. Krug and Dan Walkner joined WRT's Andy Moore last week to explain what's at stake and spread the word about a fundraiser in May at Troy Farm.
Not everybody necessarily knows the name Rooted, but a lot of people in our community, I think, are familiar with us maybe through some entity. So if you've heard of Troy Farm is part of Rooted. So Troy Farm is an urban farm on the north side. We are bringing back our CSA and pizza nights this summer. There's also community garden plots there. We have a kids garden site there. So kids come there in the summer from neighborhood centers. We also do field trips. We currently are working with an AmeriCorps farm to school program. We also have a gardener in residence program. We help maintain and provide garden educators at about 10 schools right now in Madison for garden-based education.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
no, it's
I didn't
okay.
realize there were that many
yeah,
schools
there
enrolled.
Are. We are, yeah. And
wow,
we
it really puts more heaviness on funding.
Definitely. It does. And a lot of the schools that we work with are some of the highest economically disadvantaged schools in the city, which is kind of this sense of urgency of
let's go there, at fundraising and so forth. Rooted has a big fundraiser coming up on May 24, and that's when Farm to School Aid will happen at Troy Farm in Madison. Hey, Dan, what will happen on the 24th?
Well, we're going to have a little party over at Troy Garden, Troy Farm. There's going to be music. There's going to be food. There's going to be beverages. There may be secret desserts. The music, Chris Plata, Ann Plata, my group's going to be down there playing, and then...
You have a special guest performing with you, though, too.
Teresa Marie from People Brothers is going to play. We'll probably try to sneak a couple other special people involved, get them involved. And then Tani Jacquet is going to be playing with his crew. So we kind of wanted to get people that we knew that were kind of on the scene and involved in progressive causes. And also a bunch of the people in the bands have kids in MMSD that are going to these schools that are served by the Gardens. Our kid goes to Shank. We know there's another member from Free Dirt that has a kid that goes to Shank. There's a couple kids at
Crestwood.
Our school has a school garden. The school I garden, the school I work with at Memorial, we have a school garden.
You know, it's an opportunity for you guys. Having you on is so nice because this topic is interesting. And as you're just revealing, Dan, they're probably parents of Madison school kids who have children in these schools who may not know that this
right.
program exists. Not that it's not well known, but people are busy, so right. it might be worth asking your kid, "What's up? You got a garden at school, or what's going on?"
Part of it too is that that's what, you know, the financing helps with, is like teachers are very busy and have a lot to do. And if you pile things on, then that's going to take the fun out of it. But if you have a dedicated person coming once a week or a couple times a week to your school and being like, "Let's go outside, everybody," that brings a lot of joy to it. Gets the kids out of the building.
What do children miss out on who never experience what it's like to grow a garden?
Wow, that is, to try to answer that like in a minute, I think would be hard. But one of my favorite quotes comes from Ron Finley. He's an urban gardener in California, and he says, "When kids grow kale, kids eat kale." And I've seen this happen at the Troy Kids Garden, one of our youth farm sites on the north side. I have seen kindergartners just walk past a row of kale, rip off a stem, and just like munch into it. We also have raspberries growing there. Kids go and pick them and pop them in their mouths and just declare, like, "This is the greatest day of my life." So, you know, gardens have a lot of magic in them, like watching a seed get planted and then turn into something that you can eat. It's hands-on, dig-in-the-dirt education. It motivates kids to try fruits and vegetables, to love fruits and vegetables. A lot of kids who don't feel successful in traditional classrooms also find success in the garden because it's a completely different tactile experience. So they're great for like a number of reasons, not to mention also mental health. You know, to understand where your food comes from, not to just go to a grocery store and see food on the shelf and not understand that it grows in the ground or on a tree, is really important. We need to know where our food comes from. And I think it's so important for us to learn as early as we can that like eating foods grown here in the earth is really important for our health. You know, it creates more resilient food systems if we're relying on our local agriculture as opposed to having things shipped here from California in trucks. You know, I used to teach elementary school, and I know that science was like one of those subjects that we just really weren't given a ton of time to teach during the day. I mean, science is just so fun. I would have kids that didn't really necessarily want to always be in the classroom. And anytime we would bring out the science kits, because that was the only time that we did anything hands-on, immediately they would want to be there and they would be engaged. And so never getting to have a garden means like you don't understand that this is an important, first of all, skill to learn how to grow your own food. And you also don't have, you're missing out on kind of that hands-on, dig in the dirt education where things just really come to life, where you can see a seed turn into something that you can eat. You can incorporate so many different lessons into the garden. There are so many opportunities for kids to interact with one another and for teamwork. So, and there's, you know, not to mention like all of the natural physical activities that come with it, like seeing kids pushing wheelbarrows full of mulch, carrying things together, having to figure out how to water something from a water source that's far away and doing it as a team. There's just like, it's just, it brings everything really to life.
Erica Krug and Dan Walkner. Rooted has a big fundraiser, and that's what we've been talking about, coming up on May 24. I asked Erica to check in on the phone the week prior to that so that she can remind us of all that good stuff, and so we'll be hearing from her in another month or two. So May 24, that's when Farm to School Aid will happen at Troy Farm in Madison.
It's now 6:48 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Some birds mate for life, but what happens when one of the mates is sick or injured? Feature contributor Jackie Sandberg describes some rehabilitation challenges and unanswered questions in this edition of Wildlife Weekly.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I wanted to talk about birds that are truly monogamous. And I say that because a lot of people grow up learning in school or from whatever program introduces them first to outdoor nature education that birds have a significant other that they mate for life. While that is mostly true in many species, there's only a couple that are actually truly paired until their mate dies. There are more birds than we knew of previously from years of research that actually have multiple mates or that mate with different partners during different breeding seasons. And I've been thinking about it recently because we've admitted a number of bald eagles to the Wildlife Center over the last couple of weeks. And although we haven't seen baby eagles yet, we're right in that time period where we're starting to see the evidence of our nests and babies being around, and they should be hatching here any day now. So it's one of the species that I think of as being one of those truly monogamous maters. So the bald eagle is one of them. They are some of the largest species that we have here in the United States. And one of the coolest things is they can measure up to 6 feet across and 4 feet tall. So when I hold on to a really large female eagle, it feels like it's a third of my body size because I'm fairly short. They are definitely one of those mate for life types of birds until one of the others passes away. The reason I was thinking about it was because of the number of eagles we see in rehabilitation coming in as singles, sometimes with partners. There have been times that we've had an entire group of eagles come in because of a toxicity event, for example. So I remember a couple of years ago, we had 3 eagles come in from the same exact nesting site area, one that had 2 adults and another that was probably a young of the year from the previous season that could have been a helper. And that area did have some sort of toxic event issue. But also, we could see this very often during times of year when eagles are congregating in open water spaces where they are foraging. So I think about that during this time of year in more of the winter season when there's open water, and especially along the Mississippi River and some of the open lake areas, we definitely see a huge congregation of eagles coming together. Now, while they're coming together, they may be with their mates, they may be waiting for their mates potentially, but they are going to be working on that pair bonding that happens as early as the fall, but usually sometime into the winter. And then in about March or so is when we're looking at females laying those eggs. Sometimes it's a little bit sooner, it depends on the latitude, but it's going to be about 35 days once those eggs are hatched, and then they leave the nest about 12 weeks later. So it takes a while, and both parents, the male and the female, will actually take turns incubating the eggs. It's really cool if you get the chance to log in to see some of the live monitoring cameras that they have on eagles, so a lot of the nest watching, or if you get involved with volunteer efforts to actually monitor different nests. I think that's really, really neat. So these guys are doing a display in the air when they find each other. They actually will lock their talons together. They'll do this sort of flipping in the air. They will turn around. Sometimes they'll even stay locked in their talons until they get down to the ground, which can occasionally actually cause problems. And we have had eagles come in because that mating behavior actually causes damage, or the eagles just decide not to unlock their talons, which is a little bit weird. But that pair bond can last years, many, many years. And the lifespan of an eagle can be more than 30 years in the wild. And I think that is absolutely amazing. So every year, year after year, they come back, hopefully to their same nest site, or they'll build a nest site if they've lost another one. And sometimes those nests can actually weigh over a ton of weight. And I mean an actual true ton. Usually those nests are as big as their wingspan, so at least 6 feet in diameter. And usually they're at least 6 feet off the ground, if not higher. And it's normally going to be near like an edge of a water source, so rivers, lakes, etc. But more often than not, eagles have been found nesting on other platforms and in other areas that are actually fairly urban. And they've been doing better in their populations here in Wisconsin and throughout the United States, where they are no longer considered threatened or endangered. So what makes me the most sad, I think, in our field of rehabilitation is knowing that when we get a single eagle that comes in for some sort of sickness or injury, unfortunately, it's one of a pair, right? So when I see an adult male or an adult female eagle come in, I think to myself, oh my gosh, this poor eagle has now been taken away from its one single mate who is probably looking for it. Is it going to delay the breeding season for this pair? Are they going to skip that pair bond this year and then next year find a new mate? And I think there's more research really to be done in this area of rehabilitation is when we have a single individual that is taken away for a prolonged period of time to treat them for something like lead toxicity or for a fracture or something. You know, it could take 6 months or more for that bird to be in rehabilitation and get released. And so then what happens if they miss that mating period? You know, we have done some work with other species, like, for example, my work with red-tailed hawks, looking to see if they go back to mating again in the next season, and we have found evidence of that. But the question is, what if it's a different mate? Is it the same nest? Was it the same nest as they were at previously? And what really happens to that pair bond? Does it get interrupted, and do they find each other again? I think there's more love story research that really needs to go on with some of these birds that we know of have true and very strong pair bonds. So the sad news is we've had a number of adult bald eagles that have come in over the last couple of months here to the Dane County Humane Society with high levels of lead toxicity. And just the other day, we had another one come in from the Arboretum area that also has high lead, not higher than our machine can read, but high levels. And we know that this is now the time period, again, where they'd be nesting. I worry then about the other mate. You know, did the female, we think this one might be male based on size, but we have yet to be determined, is the female incubating on eggs and now is her mate gone? And are they going to be able to continue, or will she have to find her own food and then give up on the nesting because the other partner isn't there? These are all so many things that are really difficult to know, and we don't even know if this bird actually is breeding. Maybe he has been wandering and looking for a new mate or a territory. So many unknowns in these situations, but it really makes you think, as a wildlife rehabilitator, what the impact is on those individuals and populations for these species when they're in temporary captivity while we're trying to treat them for sickness and injury, with our hope that they can go out and be successful individuals afterwards. But we have to know what is happening. Is it going to be truly successful in the situation where you have a true monogamous pair bond? So we're going to hope for the best for this eagle in rehabilitation, trying to get the lead out of the body through a technique called chelation therapy. But hopefully we'll get this bird out sooner than later, especially if there is nesting and pairing at this time period. And otherwise, you know, keep an eye out for eagles in your area. Look for nests. Look for eagles on the ground in case they need help. We are seeing evidence of them having avian influenza, and some of our partner agencies like the Minnesota Raptor Center has been doing research about different species getting avian influenza. Same with the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Minnesota as well, doing lots of research on avian flu. So we know that bald eagles can get avian flu, they can get lead toxicity, they can get sick from the Wisconsin River Syndrome virus. And we also know that those birds can fall from their nests if they're young, and you might have issues with babies coming down from windstorms or for other reasons. So definitely be on the lookout. Give us a call if you have any questions about an individual eagle, a nest, or some sort of reuniting and renesting situation where a baby has fallen. Give us a call at 608-287-3235. Otherwise, we are helping lots of bald eagles all throughout the year here at Dane County Humane Society. We appreciate you listening here on WORT about our species of concern and about rehabilitation in general. So thanks for listening here. It has been a great time at WORT. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6.
Your headline writer this evening was Aisha Malik.
Judith Rees Branch of Wisconsin News Connection was your reporter.
Special thanks to feature contributors Pete Harden, Bert Zipperer, Christine Vertigo, Andy Moore, and Jackie Sandberg.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Bay Parks produced this newscast.
Charlie Pittman is the news director at WORT, and I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm your host, Christian Knudsen. Up next is Spanish Language News with Nuestro Patio. Good night.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them to celebrate the 22nd annual Circle Fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. YWCA Madison is eager to gather with their community of supporters to share stories that speak to who they are and demonstrate their values of humanity, community, growth, and restoration, which are at the heart of how they move as an organization. Attending the Circle Fundraiser impacts the lives of thousands of women, children, and families who are served each year through YWCA's transformational programs in housing and shelter, employment and transportation, restorative justice, and learning and movement building. More information about the Circle Fundraiser and other YWCA programs and resources can be found at ywcamadison.org. That's the 22nd annual Circle Fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center. Keeping you informed of community events and resources, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
And at 7 o'clock, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, your listener-sponsored community station in Madison. Stay tuned. Coming up next, in Nuestro Patio.
Bienvenido a Nuestro Patio, un espacio en Word para la comunidad latina.
Panamá.
Presente.
Puerto Rico.
Presente.
México.
Presente.
Venezuela.
Presente.
Perú.
Presente.
República Dominicana.
Presente.
Cuba.
Presente.
Costa Rica.
Presente.
Colombia.
Presente.
Honduras.
Presente.
Ecuador.
Hola, hola, muy buenas tardes, muy buenas noches. Bienvenidos a una edición más de Nuestro Patio, el programa en español de WORT 89.9 FM, la radio comunitaria. Hoy martes 10 y... A veces se me olvida qué día es hoy. Hoy martes 18 de marzo del 2024, 10 del 2025, ven, se me olvidó. Estamos pasando por nuestra primera primavera falsa, no se hagan, no se engañen, todavía está haciendo frío, va a seguir haciendo frío, así que quizás es un buen momento para echar a lavar la ropa más pesada de invierno, pero quizás todavía la necesiten, así que no la guarden aún, una buena lavadita quizás. Y nada, hoy tenemos un